welcome to another episode of They Came From The North, coming to you monthly now, I guess, or whenever we feel like it. This is your host for the evening, Gabriel Gerard, the gremlin from Montreal. Joining me today is the human embodiment of Daffy Duck, Andrew Forbes.
What?
You're despicable.
Hi.
Ippy Commune Werewolf, John Mercer.
We lost him.
Kid the Genius, Steve Power.
I spend all my time in outer space watching television.
And put up on Suburbanite, Matt Avrak.
Hey, you're not Rockin' Ricky fans?
And this week we are discussing the career of Mr. Joe Dante. Joseph Dante Jr. was born in 1946 in Morristown, New Jersey, so somewhere near Avak's vicinity.
About 15 minutes away from me.
He began his film career working for Roger Corman as an editor on some movies, and then he co-directed Hollywood Boulevard with Alan Arkush. And after that, he was given a chance to direct his first feature movie, Piranha, which was a huge success for Roger Corman's company, costing $770,000 and raking in $6 million in the U.S. and $10 million international. So that definitely put him on the map. Before moving on to bigger things, he did an uncredited directed job on the famous cult movie Rock and Roll High School, featuring the Ramones. In 1981, he got the chance at his first Hollywood movie, The Howling, which would become another cult classic, another pretty low budget production that cost only $1.5 million and raked in $17 million, which was also co-written by John Sayles, the future indie movie director, who also wrote the script for Piranha. And who did the... I always get confused. Is it Baker?
Who did the... Boteen.
It's Boteen. Boteen on the...
right before he did the thing.
Yeah, great effects by Rob Boteen.
What thing?
Then in 1983, he was invited by Steven Spielberg to join Mr. Spielberg, George Miller, and John Landis for Twilight Zone, the movie. And he directed probably the most memorable segment, along with the one that George Miller directed. And then in 1984, his first really...
It was definitely Landis who directed the most memorable segment.
In 1984, his first blockbuster movie, his first really big hit, Gremlins, which this is the last one. I'll do the numbers because I found that interesting. His budget kept increasing, but also his revenue for his first few movies. Gremlins cost $11 million and raked in $153 million. And that one was produced by Steven Spielberg and written by Chris Columbus and became a smash hit with its little furry creatures and the scaly creatures that would develop from them. Sorry, I lost my Wikipedia page.
You mean your original script? Jeez.
I accidentally closed the Microsoft Word.
In 1985, he did the young kids' adventure movie Explorer, which was actually his first huge flop. It barely made half of what it cost to make. I think it was another Spielberg production with also input from Boteen.
I didn't know the S was silent.
Explorers.
Action burn. Continue.
Then in 1987, he made a kind of variation on the classic sci-fi movie, The Fantastic Voyage, with Inner Space. In 1989, the weirdo suburban paranoia comedy with Tom Hanks at the height of his classic 1980s Tom Hanks-ishness. and then in 1990...
Really, consulting the OED.
In 1990, he made a sequel to Gremlins, Gremlins 2, The New Batch. In 1993, the William Castle classic horror movie homage Matinee, starring Judd Goodman. 1998, Small Soldiers, or what if Toy Story? In Toy Story, the toys were violent. In 2003, he had the chance to realize a long dream of his and make a Looney Tunes feature film, which was it wasn't that big of a flop, but considering how much it cost $80 million and raked in $68 million, which is, you know, a pretty big difference considering that amount of money, and it put him in movie limbo for a while. He directed some TV and created the trailers for Mail website in the meantime, and he wouldn't make a movie until 2010, so 7 years later, with the whole 3D. Throughout his career, Dante has favored a very skewed sense of humor and a very much cult sensibility, where most of his movies are appreciated by a small audience, and he would only reach the big time a couple of times, where his sensibility would mesh with those of the general populace. So, with that said, let's start with our good or our favorite movie by Mr. Dante. Who wants to go first?
Me.
All right, go, Steve.
I've got to go with Gremlins.
Christmas movie!
I have to. Christmas movie! no, it's, you know, a caveat, I guess, to Gremlins. Gremlins is one of those movies that was released in the early Amblin days. And it's something that, you know, at the time, I still remember all the hype over Gremlins. I still remember how immensely popular it was, how excited I was when I got my little gizmo stuffed toy for Christmas that year that I still have, and at one point when you used to shake him, he used to make the gremlin sound, but he doesn't anymore. But, you know, the big thing about Gremlins was it comes from that same era as The Goonies, where people thought it was a Spielberg movie. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't associate Gremlins with Joe Dante. Most people, you know, Gremlins fans, you say, like, Joe Dante, they look at you and go, who? You know, and The Goonies is very much the same thing, you know? Like, you hear The Goonies and you think, Spielberg movie, even though it's Richard Donner, you know? And Gremlins, I mean, yeah, maybe he was a hired gun on Gremlins. Spielberg's DNA and Chris Columbus's, you know, brain are all over that movie.
I wish there was a trailer for Lethal Weapon that said from the director of The Goonies.
Yeah, or like Gremlins from the director of Howling, you know?
I mean, there definitely is a lot of Spielberg in there, but, I mean, for hires, there's a lot of Dante
no.
too.
Yes.
Yeah, I gotta agree.
And yes, there is. There definitely is. And, you know, I see that now. But when I was younger, it was, you know, it was a Spielberg movie. It was in the same category as E.T. and all that kind of stuff. And, I mean, I've grown up with Gremlins, and I always considered the Gremlins to be a Spielberg movie.
Well, it was Steven Spielberg Presents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In big letters.
And also, man, those earlier Gremlins movies, Gremlins may have had Joe Dante's eye, it had Spielberg's heart. They were all like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, Amblin movies, even right up to the last real Amblin movies, like right up to The Mask of Zorro and stuff like that, like they still had that Spielberg adventure feel, you know? But
the first half of Gremlins really feels like a Spielberg movie before it goes completely nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's got that kind of wonder to it.
Yeah.
The suburban thing and, you know, it really feels...
And then destroying the suburbs is totally Dante.
Yeah. I mean, but there's so much awesome in that movie. Once all hell breaks loose, I mean, the movie is just... It's phenomenal. There's so many great beats. You know, Mrs. Deagle and the Futtermans, and you know.
But the rules don't make sense.
It's a Kentucky Haps.
No.
It's a Kentucky Haps.
It's after midnight.
I love that. I love so much of that movie. It's just so much fun. And, you know, even when it does get dark and it does get serious and creepy, it still has that kind of almost winking at the audience kind of feel. You know, it's like, yeah, we are getting dark and we are getting serious, but at the same time.
There's a toy car chase.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You know, it has this whimsical feel, even when it is, you know, even like the scene in the bar when Kate's telling the story about her dad and stuff like that. You know, it still has this kind of kitschiness about it that could only be, you know, I can't even say that's Dante for sure, you know, like, it's Dante, or, you know, if someone had told me it was John Landis, I would have said, yep, okay, sure, you know, but, yeah, it's such a fun movie, and there's not a single element of it that I can say, you know, oh, I wish he hadn't done that, or that was a poor decision, or, oh, I hate this, or, I enjoy pretty much every aspect of Gremlins.
Something that really works for me with, the first Gremlins, but not so much with the second one, is that it's such a very plain, normal suburban town.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely everyday, average, plain town, and to unleash these ridiculous Gremlin monsters onto them, that really, the contrast really works.
One thing that I noticed on rewatch is that it's kind of inspired by its modern It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, so it's definitely taking that small town aspect that Capra created back then.
One thing I missed in the second movie is the sense of menace. Like, I felt the second movie. I'll try to talk mostly about the first, but the first one has this sort of sense of
evil is going on.
I kind of feel like the second one lost focus. The first one was so focused with this great little concept and just playing it out straight that it works as the balance between comedy and horror is a lot. I think it's handled better in the first one. And there are images from the first one and even just sort of tones I think of in the first one that definitely make it a lot more memorable to me.
I mean, I know kids my age, like, well, not kids now, obviously, but people my age who were kids when Gremlins came out, and my wife being one of them, who will not watch the movie now because they were so terrified by it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, I love it. I grew up with it, but I'm the same. E.T. I mean, E.T. terrified the ever-loving shit out of me when I was 5. So, you know?
Yep.
But
my first exposure to Gremlins was actually a, like, 7-inch record that played just...
The record and book?
Just the scene of them tearing up the bar.
Yeah, the record and the...
Yeah.
So turn the page when you hear this sound.
Yeah. And... So basically, the entire movie was about monsters in a bar for the first 5 years that I knew about Gremlins.
I still have that.
You're like that Russian dude from Running Scared, man, with his 12-minute-long cut of the Cowboys. Only instead of John Wayne living in the end, yours was 12 minutes of terror.
And that's got to be my favorite part of the movie, the rampage in the bar.
Yeah.
But it starts going to these little sketches, which Dante does really well. It suddenly becomes like this workout video with the Gremlins.
Flash dance.
This dance, yeah, flash dance. Like, what the hell is going on in this movie?
These sort of little character bits with the individual Gremlins that I thought just took over the second movie, but as a smaller element in the first, I thought worked really
well. Yeah.
And the one with the little gremlin playing with the dopey hand puppet before the other guy shoots him.
Yeah. And
I love Billy's Billy's insane father.
Randall Peltzer was awesome.
With his what was his device? It was like a Swiss Army knife with
like a shaving kit and toothpaste, yeah.
You got yourself a bad case of dragon breath.
I do have to. One thing I do want to mention is for me, the most memorable thing about the movie is the kitchen sequence.
Oh man,
yes,
because that to me was. It's so incredibly violent. If they weren't green monsters.
No. I mean, those were jokes that we told to each other when we were kids. You know, what's green and red and goes 100 miles an hour? A gremlin in a blender.
There's Gremlins and Temple of Doom, and they're responsible for the PG-13 rating, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Those two. Mostly because of that scene.
I'm still amazed at that story about the dad who gets cut in the chimney. That's such, like...
It's pretty dark.
Yeah. And it comes out from nowhere. You're like, okay.
It's pretty brutal. And the end of it when... I don't know who did the effects. Was it Baker did the effects for this movie?
I think so. I know for the second one it's definitely Baker. First one...
Do you think that they included that story just because Spielberg was producing and he needed, like, an absent father story?
Chris Wallace designed them.
Yeah.
But just, like, the practical effects were, like, the end of it when Stripe comes out of that fountain. Mm-hmm. Man, that was brutal.
Oh, that explains something. He's the same guy who did the creature effects for The Fly.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, that explains the goopiness of Stripes to me.
Yeah, like that melting gremlin, man, that was savage. Still really well done.
You want to know something, though? That put hair on my chest. Kids these days are soft.
And yes, everything else aside, it is a Christmas movie.
Yes.
When my kid's 5 years old, I'm going to sit him down and make him watch a snuff movie.
It's a good Christmas movie along with, like, Die Hard, little non-traditional Christmas movies that
only
Christmas movies I'll watch.
Yeah, they're still Christmas movies because they're about unity and all of that kind of stuff. Like, we had that conversation a little while ago. I think it was myself and Mercer and probably Davin. And we talked about, you know, what makes the difference between a Christmas movie and a movie that happens at Christmas time, you know? Like, Lethal Weapon you'd never associate with a Christmas movie,
no.
But it does happen at Christmas time. But Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know? And it's...
Although, you know what? In the defense of Lethal Weapon as Christmas movie, I'm sure a number of people have Christmases that end up with two people fighting on their lawn.
Actually, my sister and I have a theory. We have a theory about how Lethal Weapon is a retelling of A Christmas Carol. And how it's the three ghosts are visiting Riggs to make him change his ways.
Interesting.
Before he kills himself. The ghost of Christmas future is Mr. Joshua.
Wow.
Riggs overcomes despair by breaking its neck. Actually, no, he doesn't break Joshua's neck.
He just chokes.
No, he and Tiny Tim, or no, it's... No, Danny Glover's Bob Cratchit, sorry. They they unleashed the spirit of the holidays.
Hey, you guys aren't Rockin' Ricky Rialto fans?
All right. That's as good as a place as any to segue into my good, which is Gremlins 2. Now... I love this movie because it is so crazy and insane and off the chain. And it's basically, to me, it's the Looney Tunes movie that Joe Dante always wanted to make before he knew he was going to eventually direct a Looney Tunes movie. Just so many flashes of brilliance and just sheer insanity in this movie. And
the noodle cheese product chowder surprise.
I love how, like, it's a take on all these, like, you know, big businesses are evil movies and stuff, but the actual multimillionaire guy is actually pretty decent.
It's like, you know, the Gremlins, like the first movie, Gremlins, crossed with Brazil.
John Glover is definitely the most entertaining member of the cast, I think.
When is John Glover not entertaining, though?
Are we talking about John Magnavold Glover?
Yes.
Oh, John Magnavold Glover, indeed.
Well, him and Christopher Lee.
Never put that. That's a pretty good name.
Yeah. But I mean, all that stuff with the Silence Lab, where they inject gremlins with special stuff and they get special powers. I mean, you know that most of the budget was spent on creating each individual gremlin and thinking of stuff for them to do. And I mean, where else would you see gremlins doing a musical number on New York, New York? I mean, this is a movie that I've seen. This is one of the movies I've seen the most often in my life. And I still enjoy it immensely. And I'm entertained every time I watch it. I don't know. I think it's just pure fun in a bottle to me.
Gizmo snapping and becoming Rambo is like my favorite part of this movie.
I was about to say whoever's idea it was to give him a red headband, a paperclip bow, and actually set a bottle of liquid paper on fire. That was brilliant.
The epic music bellowing up as he.
Don't you hear like Richard Crenna saying something over to?
Yeah.
Like Mary.
You want to survive war, you got to become war.
Isn't that the clip that gets played?
Yes. And just, you know, the fact that, I mean, this is a movie that was making meta jokes, but for fun, you know, like the gremlin bat going through the window and making the bat signal.
Yeah.
Or the movie starting to burn in the middle, and then, like, imagine being in the theater and that happening, you know? Mm-hmm. And you think that the movie is actually running out, but then suddenly you see, like, the usher going to see Hulk Hogan, and then Hulk Hogan going crazy at the gremlins.
The Leonard Maltin cameo?
Leonard Maltin cameo was brilliant.
I will say this for Gremlins 2. I'm not quite as fond of it as Gabe, but I think the best thing about the Phoebe Cates father story in the first movie is the payoff.
Anyway, we don't have time for this.
You're just like Abe Lincoln, except for the trench coat.
A funny thing about Cates 2 is that, like, Zach Gilligan hasn't gotten any better as an actor, but you can see that Cates is actually a bit better. I mean, some of her expressions are priceless in this movie.
Gilligan's fine. I mean, he's just supposed to be this sort of
everyman,
relatively innocuous.
Yeah.
But just, I love the stare she gives to the redhead when she's trying to wrap Billy around her finger. She's like, she's really like burning through her with those eyes.
Hmm.
You know what I like about Gremlins 2? The Nintendo game was good.
I remember that.
It was hard.
Great soundtrack, man. Fucking Sunsoft.
I like that they, you know, in Hollywood tradition, typically, you know, a sequel was to play it up more, you know, whereas with Gremlins 2, they just kind of, it's like, what? People want us to make a sequel to this? Okay, you know?
Yeah. You can tell he was having a lot of fun.
Yeah, they did not give a shit. Not a single fuck was given that day.
And, I mean, that's what I love about it. You know, he took advantage of the extra budget to make the movie he exactly wanted and just, you know, put wanton destruction up on screen. And there's just so many memorable stuff, you know, that that guy who's the Dracula host, or the cooking with Marge where she's like swilling on the bottle as she's cooking or whatever.
Everyone knows you never put pots and pans in a microwave.
How about the that dessert? They said it's a Canadian dish. The chocolate mousse. Is that any authenticity to that, guys? Mousse. Is that real? You guys have
that? No.
Bring one down. Well, that's an inaccuracy then. I was lied to.
Definitely.
One more thing I'll say too for both Gremlins movies is that Gizmo is like the most cute, adorable little creature, and everyone wants one. Every other Mogwai is a little shit. They're all little obnoxious
little
things.
Bastards.
Little rodent creature infestation things. He's cute. He's the only one.
But he hosts Deal or No Deal.
He does.
Therefore. Hey, that was good.
That was good. Thank
you. All right, somebody save us from this.
I will go. My good is The Howling. It's the movie, I think, that is... most manages to sort of maintain a tone of horror throughout it, of the horror movies that Joe Dante has done. And the effects that Rob Bottin did are amazing. The whole idea of werewolf movie in this kind of new age, sort of culty slash self-help group out in the woods.
The hippie commune.
Mixed up with this search for a serial killer. It sounds like a real mishmash, but John Sayles did a really good job of bringing all these elements together. I don't know how much came from the original novel. It's apparently based on a novel by some guy called Gary Brandner.
Very, very little, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, his novels are more... all the shit sandwich sequels are based more heavily on his novels.
And also, I find that a lot of the time Dante movies can have a lot of imagination in them in terms of conceptualizing, but the actual execution of them isn't always that effective. But I think The Howling is really stylish. It looks amazing, especially the early sequences with Dee Wallace sort of walking around in this scuzzy downtown and going into this like porn video shop and meeting with this serial killer. And it's incredibly creepy and incredibly well shot.
That beginning could almost come out from a Scorsese movie or something.
Yeah, and I mean the relationship between her and her, I can't remember if they're actually married or if they're if her and her boyfriend.
No, that's her husband.
Yeah, and sort of the weird kind of effects that being in this commune has on the two of them and on their relationship. And actually, I already mentioned that the effects were great, but I want to come back to them because people tend to go on and on about how great An American Werewolf in London's effects were and the transformation, which is true. But I don't think The Howling gets nearly enough credit for how effective the transformation is and how creepy the monster designs are.
I actually think the Eddie transformation is better in The Howling, mainly because the end result in The Howling, it actually looks like a giant walking wolf.
Yeah.
Whereas American Werewolf in London, it looks more like a monkey with a snout.
There's that, but I mean also...
American Werewolf's transformation to me was always more like...
You get the sense that there's still that sort of weird person in there with kind of the damp, junky hair sort of hanging over their face, and it's really... It's disturbing in a way that not enough werewolf movies are.
Yeah.
You really got that sense of deformation and the only bad effect, to my memory anyway, in the movie is a really, really awful animated silhouette of two characters transforming against the fire.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Which just jumps out as, you know, somebody said, we can probably do it like this and it'll look great, and they did it, and then they'd already spent the money and they couldn't afford to to find another way of doing it.
I mean, this is a movie that only costs $1.5 million, you know.
And for a movie that costs $1.5 million, it is a good-looking movie.
Ladies and
gentlemen,
Rob Bottin.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. It's The Howling was also my choice for good.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately... it's impossible, really, to talk about it without making the comparisons to American Werewolf in London. Mainly because, you know, they're both werewolf movies that came out in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
But I always found The Howling's it's a much more ambitious movie,
mm-hmm.
despite costing, you know, 10% of what American Werewolf cost.
That's a cooler poster.
Much cooler poster. Whereas I found, you know, and I brought this up in our Landis episode a long time ago. You know, Landis was happy to throw schlocky nightmare sequences and a wafer-thin plot on top of one famous transformation sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas The Howling actually, you know, attempts to ratchet up tension a little bit and actually be a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just, you know, being a monster movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love the...
I'm glad you said that, because that's a distinction that not enough people make a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it is, that's a really good point. The difference between the two. I mean, Landis obviously loves Schlock, and Dante does too.
So does Dante. They're both born out of the late night movies.
Mm-hmm.
They're both Schlock peddlers.
You remember the little kid from The Iron Giant?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hogarth grew up to be Joe Dante. But, no, like, I love all the stuff about all the Eddie Quist stuff. I wish there was more of it in the movie. That bit when the main character's best friend and the photographer boyfriend go into his apartment and you see all the sketches and everything he's drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all the wolf drawings.
One thing that's missing is a proper grounding. They didn't really have enough time, I suspect. I think they probably guessed that people would be impatient, but I do wish there was maybe an extra 10 minutes at the opening of the movie to sort of set the stage for.
Yeah, because it just opens up with the police sting, doesn't it, with her walking?
Yeah. Which in a sense is good because it disorients you a bit and it makes you sort of on edge. But
well, that opening is absolutely horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if you were to catch the movie on TV and, not see the opening title card and not realize, you know, okay, it's called The Howling. It's about werewolves. Because, I mean, they don't pull the trigger on the werewolf stuff until a good ways into the movie, right?
Well, it's at least a third of the way in, I think.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things where, you know, you got this... I mean, Eddie's a fucked up character. And I love that stuff. And... another thing that I find it's really strong about it, it's got a great supporting cast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Robert Picardo is amazing. I love Slim Pickens.
Slim Pickens. Yeah. Carradine. It's got Kenneth McCarthy.
Kevin McCarthy.
Noble Willingham's in there somewhere.
Yeah. Patrick McNee. I mean,
as a doctor.
Yeah.
He slathers on the cheese pretty thick, but it's in his character to do so.
Yeah, exactly. It makes sense for the character.
Yeah. And, you already brought up the absolutely dreadful hand-animated part. Every time I was a kid scene, it's just like, what? What?
Well, that's the thing about Dante. I find that usually his casting is very well done. And, I mean, he does have a group of regulars that, you know, I think Dick Miller has been in every of his movie ever since Piranha.
Excuse me, the immortal Dick Miller. I don't think the man has ever aged.
Is that Mr. Futterman?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
Hey, Ducky, oh.
He's the one gets them the silver bullets in The Howling.
Yeah.
I think he was also the gun shop owner in the first Terminator.
Yes, he was.
Just I like to think see. They exist in the same universe.
I think he was a Roger Corman regular, and that's where they hooked up with Cameron and Dante.
I mean, he did stuff like Blood and, you know, a bunch of early movies with Corman.
Hey, kids, take these silver bullets and kill the werewolf. They won't fail you. It's a Kentucky Harvester.
Oh, and also, great end credits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just the shot of the, like, rare or raw ground beef cooking on the...
one thing I'll give The Howling, I mean, I'm not a massive fan. I don't love it or hate it, you know? Like, I don't really... I can't say anything negative about the movie because I don't really...
It's better than American Werewolf, Steve.
Oh, it's much better. I hate American Werewolf. But anyway, it's a decent flick. I'm not really into the werewolf flicks. I'm not really into the creature features. So, you know, it's kind of, I guess, a little bit of it is lost on me. But it's entertaining enough. You know, I liked it enough. And I could watch it on a technical level and really enjoy it. And I will say it's got the second best on-screen werewolves ever.
Cool.
What's the best on-screen werewolf?
I'm not telling.
It's Van Helsing, isn't
it? It is Van Helsing. Man, those werewolves were badass.
Oh, my God.
The movie was terrible. Those werewolves looked awesome.
But it's the only movie where I got in for free and still felt ripped off.
I never said it was a good movie. I just said the werewolf boss, man.
Yeah, the design of the wolves, and it was actually pretty cool.
Pretty amazing. Not pretty cool. Pretty amazing.
I'm not a fan of Dog Soldiers either, but the actual design of the werewolves is pretty good in that.
Dog Soldiers.
Is there where I mentioned Ginger Snaps? Or
yes, you beat me to it. You beat me to it.
Ginger Snaps is a good movie, but it doesn't have a great werewolf.
No.
No, and Ginger Snaps' werewolf is like a giant ape. You know, they took this, like, willowy
that giant ape is pubing out.
what it looks like is they took the face off the werewolf from American Werewolf and stuck it on the sandworm from Dune.
Wow.
Alright, there's one shot in Ginger Snaps that kind of looks like Nathan Jones squatting in the woods.
Oh my God. Avra, get us out of this. What's your good?
Alright, I have to pick Interspace as my good. Interspace is a movie I grew up with.
Wait. You're forgetting a They Come From the North rule.
What's that?
If Martin Short's involved in a movie, it can't be. It just can't make the good list.
This is the exception to that. That's actually one of the amazing things about this.
I really have to read that guidebook.
That's more of a law of science, but I know. But he manages to be pretty good in this one. Meg Ryan too. I grew up with Interspace. And I swear I'm the only person who saw this movie growing up. Uh-huh. I love this movie. We used to me and my dad and I used to rent this movie. There's no explanation why not everyone grew up with this in the 80s. It's just a really cool little adventure movie. On one hand, you've got this back and forth trying to steal the science chip, all that madness, and then you've got Dennis Quaid miniaturized Fantastic Voyage inside Martin Short. So you've got two different kinds of adventures happening at the same time. It is totally loads of fun. Martin Short
well managed to lose a few pounds between Commando and this.
He's great in it, Mr. Igo. He's terrifying in that movie.
It's kind of weird, man, because he ballooned up huge between Road Warrior and Commando, and then got pretty svelte after that.
He let out some steam.
Exactly.
Oh, that's what, it was the steam. Arnold didn't kill him. He saved his life.
Hello, John.
I first saw a few movies
I don't need to go.
Verna Wells, between The Road Warrior, this, and Commando, I didn't realize he was the same actor until I was like 20. I thought these were all different people.
Oh, dude, imagine the shock. Vernon Wells does one of the best devils I've ever seen in a video game.
Which is that?
Darksiders. I didn't realize it until he said the word gate. He pronounces it exactly like in The Road Warrior.
But yeah, like, in a space, I mean, I think it might have been, like, until he made Gremlins 2, it was probably his biggest budget picture. And because it looks really great, and there's a lot of effects in it. And I think it works really well on a pure blockbuster adventure fun, you know? It fits well with stuff like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or, you know, that kind of fun adventure from the 80s.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed Interspace. I had a lot of fun with Interspace, but it's a movie that I didn't see for a long time. And when I went back to it, it left me kind of cold, actually. But it was one, I mean, like you, Matt, it was one I grew up with. It was one myself and my dad did watch a bunch. It used to come on TV a lot. One of our cable channels used to show it all the time. So, I mean, I'd seen it dozens of times. But it just, after the VHS era kind of faded, it was a while before I stumbled onto it again.
Yeah, was, did ASN used to get all that stuff from TBS?
ASN! Oh my God, flash from the past.
I don't know.
No, I think it was ASN, because I think they used to, all their movies they used to show were all stuff they got from the Turner Library.
Oh, possibly.
I came to Innerspace really late. I didn't grow up with it. And I remember, you know, I watched it, and it was decent fun. And it was definitely, definitely way better than Fantastic Voyage. It was like Joe Dante was making the Fantastic Voyage, and he had this great idea. Man, what if the Fantastic Voyage was actually fun?
Yeah. And
what's the name of the movie? Hold on, guys. I know this is going to sound crazy, but we're going to make a movie about shrinking people inside other people's bodies, but it's going to be a fun movie instead of a tedious movie.
Oh, my God. Somebody get Joe Dante to remake The Black Hole.
Man, The Black Hole isn't nearly as bad as Fantastic Voyage.
We're going to make a movie about deep space with a terrifying 18-foot-tall robot, and it's not going to suck this time.
And the robot is not going to look like a trash can.
Can we still have Slim Pickens voicing a weird garbage can with googly eyes?
No, because he's dead.
Oh.
And I have to mention some of his players again. Robert Picardo as Cowboy.
Yes. That face transformation scene.
And man, does Kevin McCarthy make a great villain. He's got like, you know, he's got that smug, like, I own the world face that you just want to punch, and he's great at doing it.
I'd also like to point out that Lieutenant Tuck Pendleton is a perfect name for a military.
Dude, that's...
Go get him, Tuck.
When I saw Pacific Rim, the first time I heard the name Herc Hansen, that's the first thing popped in my head.
I still haven't watched Pacific Rim, anyway.
Don't worry about it. I wouldn't bother.
This Inner Space is great with the names, man. Ozzy Wexler. Victor Scrimshaw.
Victor Scrimshaw.
Man, I would love to have the name Scrimshaw.
Mr. Igo.
Dr. Greenbush. I got that looked at.
I was about to say, you'd have a song written after you by Cypress Hill, but that was Dr. Green Thumb.
And it has Orson Bean, which is always worth mentioning.
Henry Gibson. How many of Dante's movies did he show up in?
Oh, a few, too. Yeah. Douglas.
Two. Burbs.
Illinois Nazis.
He was the only good part of the Burbs.
Hey.
Mm. Well, we'll be getting there soon.
That's just...
any more thoughts on Inner Space, Matt?
I just gotta say, if you have kids, make them watch it. They'll thank you. It's a great movie.
They'll learn a lot about human anatomy.
Yeah, right.
Netflix, get on that shit. Great poster, yes, man. That Interspace's poster
that
was awesome.
Great. Was that a Struzan?
It was Struzan or one of the Struzan copycats.
Yeah.
It's the one I'm thinking about, the thumb and forefinger with the ship in between it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I guess that does it for our good. Now we'll transition to our bads. So either movies that are good, but that we like, but have too many flaws to really be called good, or, yeah, just movies that we don't really like that much, but we don't really hate either, that kind of work, but are kind of meh, I guess. Who wants to go first?
Okay.
Actually, man, I was going to say I'll go because I was hoping my Burbs thing would segue in.
All right, go for it.
Interception. Balls in my court.
Balls in your mouth.
Balls.
I mean, what? Shut up.
Yeah, no, it's only going to keep it short. The Burbs is one of those movies I've never really gotten. It's, I can't say I never really got. I understand it completely, but it's just one of those ones. A lot of people I know loved it, and I never really understood the appeal of it. You know, when I was a kid, I had my cousins Dan and Jay used to rent it all the time. Loved it, but I mean, at the time, I was interested in other comedies. You know, Hanks is a great, strong comedic lead. A lot of people forget just how good he was in comedies before he reinvented himself as an Oscar-winning machine in the 90s.
What, he didn't win an Oscar for The Burbs?
No.
Drag it out.
there's a couple things show up in the Burbs that I read. Like I love Bruce Dern in it.
Yes.
I love Henry Gibson's fish face doctor. I wish he was in it more, actually. But it's it lacks the hurt of a lot of Dante Stronger material.
I enjoy the Burbs.
Yeah.
You know, I do. I like the movie. But I will say it was, I mean, the reason the Burbs is remembered today as well as it is, which is not to say that it's, you know, world-renowned or anything, but the reason it is remembered as much as it is, it has more to do with the guy whose face is all over the video slash DVD cover than the fact that it was a Joe Dante movie or anything redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a Tom Hanks vehicle at a time when Tom Hanks' star was huge, you know?
Yeah, was this post-Big?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I also chose the Burbs as my good. As we said earlier, Dante has a lot of great ideas that don't necessarily career into something, you know, a successful movie. And I think that's what the Burbs was. I mean, it's a great concept with, like, you know, the suburban guy thinking, like, his neighbors are evil and strange going-ons and all that paranoia. And, I mean, the way he shoots it is, you know, he's still got a great eye, and there's some, you know, there's a great energy and, you know, great use of Dutch angles and all that stuff. But in the end, it doesn't come into a hole. And I always hated the ending of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to spoil it here.
Go ahead.
So, basically, all through the movie, Tom Hanks is, like, spying on the neighbors, breaking into their house because they're foreign weirdos, and he thinks they're up to something. And then, like, at the end, he blows up their house and everything, and the police comes over and, like, what have you done? These are perfectly responsible people, na-na-na. And so he has this moment of, like, realization, oh, I've been a huge creep, you know? And, like, he shames everybody else. But then he finds human bones in their car. Yeah. So it turns out they were bad after all. And
it pulled the punch.
It just ruins it.
I'd say that was had more to do with, you know, the whole Hollywood focus testing machine. And, you know, Tom Hanks can't be the bad guy. He was the kid.
Yeah.
You know,
even if it stuck with that though, and it made it all just their own paranoia, I even thought that was even a little too deep for the movie.
The movie, was,
you know, yeah, it was a better ending. It was a good ending, but it would have been a good ending to a movie that didn't quite deserve it.
Yeah, yeah. It was. My biggest memory is just how dark it is. It's a pretty dark movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's filmed even like, you know, almost like monochromatic. It's almost got this black and white look to it. It's almost, dare I say, Burton-esque in how it's shot.
And that's my thing with it, is that it's like a Tim Burton movie that never quite gets to being a Tim Burton movie.
Not enough spirals.
Yeah, like it's you know, it's not as funny as Pee-wee and not as vicious as Beetlejuice.
And I'll just, something good about it, I always like seeing Carrie Fisher in something that's not Star Wars and be good in it.
She was fantastic in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Is this the only one of Joe Dante's movies to have Dick Miller and Robert Picardo appear in the same scene? I'm like, this can't happen, the world's going to explode. It's like time copy. I can't have them both in the same place.
But, I mean, I still enjoy it. And, you know, if I'm watching TV or something and it pops up, I'll totally watch it. But, I mean, it's kind of just there.
Yeah.
But as I was telling before the podcast, if somebody asked me to explain what Tom Hanks was about back in the 80s, I'd show Big and The Burbs. Because I think The Burbs and maybe the Money Pit is like Tom Hanks being the best Tom Hanks comedy Tom Hanks that he was.
You sit down and watch Big or The Burbs and then have someone tell you he's going to win an Oscar in less than 10 years for playing a gay guy who's dying of AIDS. You're going to look at him and say, you're so full of shit.
Less than 5 years.
Yeah.
All right, so Forbes, you wanted to go first. You get to go next.
All right. Well, now I've started second-guessing myself. I don't know if I want to go with Piranha or Small Soldiers. I'll go with Piranha.
We'll get to Small Soldiers, Andrew.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
So Piranha, it's fine, which is something I say about a lot of Joe Dante movies. It's fine.
It's good to throw.
It's got Bradford Dillman, the guy you get when you can't get Charlton Heston or the next guy down the Charlton Heston ladder. It's got Kevin McCarthy, who's really terrible in it. Dick Miller's there, Barbara Steele's there. So it's got a fairly solid exploitation cast. It is absolutely a Corman movie. This is before Dante... I'd say it's before he developed a visual style. I'm not entirely convinced he ever really did. He got polished. But it's not as colorful as his later movies. It obviously didn't have a lot of money to work with. But it does have moments of imagination. There's a fantastic shot of someone getting pulled down under the water in a cloud of blood. That's just really, really simple and eerie. And I think it was used in like all the trailers. It's clearly ripping off Jaws, and it's one of those nature fights back movies along with, all of those, frogs are killing us, giant rabbits are killing us, whatever.
Wow, what was that John Frankenheimer movie?
Prophecy with the like bear beast fighting back against Armand Asante. It's fairly conventional, but it does have like a few wacky moments in it, and it's obviously made by a filmmaker who's excited to get the chance to, step behind the camera and show what he can do. It's got Paul Bartel in a small but awesome role. He's always amazing, I think, when he shows up, because he's just such a bizarre personality and character on screen. It doesn't have a lot of effects. I think people probably, if they haven't watched it and go back, they kind of assume that it's going to have a lot of gory effects and things, and it doesn't have that many. But it does have some fairly convincing, people getting dragged out of the water with covered in bites or with, just a bone where their calf should be. It does the job. It's funny. It's occasionally horrifying, but it's just fairly workmanlike at the same time.
As far as Jaws or Puff go, you can do much, much worse.
Oh yeah, you absolutely can. It's definitely not Orca.
Hey.
Orca's a great comedy.
You leave Orca alone. That's one of the only things we have, okay?
Alright, who's next? Steve?
Sure.
Matt?
I'll go. My bad, I went with Small Soldiers.
Woohoo!
Hey. I actually like Small Soldiers a lot. It's kind of a retread of Gremlins in a lot of ways. But it's the whole thing with the, it's a movie that shouldn't be as fun as it is. Like, I dismissed it when I first heard about it, and I somehow got dragged to seeing it. But it's really a lot of fun, Small Soldiers. Just the toys come alive and become, they're given these military grade chips, and I guess they aren't product tested enough, and they end up laying siege to a house to try to get their arch enemies, the Gorgonites. And somehow this is just ridiculously fun. The voices of the small soldiers are Tommy Lee Jones along with a bunch of the Dirty Dozen. And the Gorgonites are led by Frank Langella and some of the cast of Spinal Tap. You just can't go wrong with this. And it ends up kind of like Gremlins, being this absolutely ridiculous thing that you're watching that ends up being a blast as a result.
I also you know, I said I was, it was a toss up between Piranha and this for my bad. I similarly dismissed it when I first saw, I'm sure I saw the trailer when I was at the theater sometime. And I sort of,
it was a pretty heavily promoted advertised movie, actually, yeah.
And it was sort of one of those last resort, like, you know, I was at the video store, they said, you know, you've rented two movies, you can get a third one free. Oh, I'll get Small Soldiers. And, you know, a friend and I, you know, were sitting there and watched three movies in a row. And it was, if Joe Dante has a characteristic, it's taking a movie that you expect to be fairly light and putting more darkness in it than you anticipate. Mm-hmm. And that's something about Small Soldiers that I really like. And the cast is unreal.
Mm-hmm. The Barbie dolls.
Yeah, the Barbie dolls are amazing. Christina Ricci and Sarah Michelle Gellar are the Gwendy dolls. Then, I mean, the rest of the cast, Harry Shearer, Michael McKean, Christopher Guest, George Kennedy, Bruce Dern, Jim Brown, Ernest Borgnine, Frank Langella, Tommy Lee Jones, Robert Picardo, Phil Hartman's in it, you know, and then David Cross is in it, Dick Miller's in it. Really, the only thing I remember actively disliking was the super generic kid who, you know, I just assumed in my head that it was Devon Sawa. Looking back, because it was just one of those super bland white kids from the late 90s. He's Gregory Smith, apparently.
It doesn't help that his partner is Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah. But, you know, I think he was rocking the center part, wasn't he? It's a good 90s haircut.
I think he had an undercut. Like, actually, no, wait, no. It was 98. They wouldn't have undercuts anymore.
But he had the unbuttoned plaid shirt.
And again, like with Gremlins, one of the great fun with it is all the things the soldiers can take and make, you know, deadly things with normal things laying around your house.
Yeah.
The tennis balls on fire being shot into the house that she has to bat back out with the tennis racket.
Mm. Nick Knight, a reporter for duty, sir. Demolition is my mission.
I mean, future, I guess, is it doesn't feel original at all because it's really basically Gremlins 3.
That's really it. Like, it stands on its own. It's good. Like,
well, the thing about first, it is, awesome, you know, for someone who feels about Gremlins 2 as I do, like, again, it brings it back down to the smaller premise of, like, these seemingly innocuous things laying siege to, you know, you're in your home, you think you're safe, and there's all these little things running around. I mean, it's a little bit Home Alone too because of all the homemade such. But
in my, I was saying that this is basically what I wish the Transformers movie would have been.
That would have been amazing.
And they're blasting the Spice Girls song as warfare.
Yeah,
I love this song.
Isn't there Led Zeppelin in this movie somewhere too?
Probably.
At a time when, like, Led Zeppelin were never in movies.
I'm sorry to backtrack a little, but while we're talking music, I forgot about the Burbs. One of the things I enjoy the most is the Jerry Goldsmith's score on that movie is very fun and horror film. Goldsmith scored the majority of Dante's movies.
That's a lot of what works about Small Soldiers, too, is that the score is just so serious.
That was Goldsmith, too, I believe.
It's so epic. How everyone thinks these toys are so mundane, but the toys themselves are taking themselves so seriously.
Also, Chip Hazard's demise is pretty horrifying.
I have to say, I'm not a Small Soldiers fan.
Neither am I. We'll get to that now in a couple of minutes.
I hate the Gorgonites.
Yeah.
Hate.
Yeah. But Evan Carter.
Hate.
Yes.
Hate so much.
Yes.
I remember Gene Siskel going absolutely cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over Ocula, I think his name is the big eyeball one.
Yeah.
That was when I realized Gene Siskel was full of shit.
It's okay, you got cancer and died. So
hate.
You won.
Hey! Flames on the sides of my face.
So,
Steve, what's your bad?
It's not Small Soldiers, oddly enough.
You love that movie.
Anyway, moving on. Shut up.
In his heart of hearts, he wishes he loved Small Soldiers.
My bad, as in movie that I love the shit out of, but is definitely a flawed movie, I have to go with The Explorers.
Woohoo!
It's a fantastic movie, and I don't give a shit what anybody says. It's
yeah. River Phoenix's parents were in a sex cult.
Thank you, John. But no, it's
no wonder Lee Phoenix is so fucked up.
Explorers is, you know, it very much follows that whole Spielberg blueprint. Like very, very, very much. But I don't
another
think...
great poster too, man.
Mm-hmm.
Another Amblin movie with a fucking Aces poster.
Yeah, and I wanted a tilt-a-whirl ride thingy just to make a spaceship out of it. I really seen this movie. So much in a movie that works so well for me is the payoff, like the build-up, that when the kids are discovering, you know, when River Phoenix is discovering this little energy ball thing, and they're, you know, they're working on putting together this spaceship and stuff. Like, it's this stuff that I really got into as a kid, and I still, like, really enjoy today. You get to that final act, you get to the payoff, and it loses something in the payoff.
Yes.
And it's not the goofiness of the alien. The goofiness of the alien's okay. I can accept the goofiness of the alien, and I can accept the whole, you know, he just sits up there in his spaceship watching TV, and he's actually just a kid or whatever, you know, okay.
Yeah.
But just something about how that final act unfolds that kind of...
Well, the movie was rushed into completion.
Yeah.
And you can definitely feel that. But
it's
still, I mean,
a different movie.
I mean, it's a Dante movie, and I know a lot of people give it slack for those goofy aliens, but I'm like, in my head, I think it was a parody of all finding, you know, meaning in outer space and stuff. You know, the kind of seriousness of let's go to outer space and we'll find the answer to our questions and stuff. No, you just find a kid who's the first thing he says is "What's up, Doc?" when he meets you.
Yeah,
you find someone who's just like you, you know.
And
I like
when they're being chased around the spaceship by what they think is a malevolent force. It's actually pretty cool, you know. It's pretty intense.
That's Robert Picardo as the voice of Whack and as the voice of the father. Not just the voice. I think he was in the whole suit, actually.
Oh,
yeah, he was. That was him. I mean, the thing with the goofiness. I mean, I got to agree with Steve on just about everything. But the whole build up was great. But the last act, it just feels like this is it. You know, I get it being goofy, but he kept making all these stupid impressions that, you know, you can't enjoy if you're over the age of like 8. You know, it just kept being nonstop. Here's another impression. Here, Ed Sullivan now, right? And you just kept going.
Yeah.
Impression after impression after impression after impression for like 20 minutes, and it was just, you know, it just got dumb.
It just becomes, you know, a bunch of kids watching a stand-up routine.
Yeah.
You know?
To me, it felt like it feels like a screenplay that didn't have a third act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they started making the movie just on based on the concept, and it's a great concept. You know, sci-fi adventure movies about a bunch of kids who build a spaceship in their backyard, right? But to me, it's just like they never really knew what they were going to do once they got into space.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I enjoy it. I have a lot of fun with it.
I think what's really relatable in that whole build-up is that it does really capture that feeling that you had of playing with your friends and making believe, you know? Like, if you forget about the fact that they're actually making a spaceship, you can see yourself, you know, making the spaceship and making up that you're going on these adventures with your friends and stuff.
And it really captures that feeling like only a few movies can.
I mean, you better goddamn believe that if I found an abandoned Tilt-A-World ride, I'd be totally taking an Apollo capsule out of that shit, man. And there would,
dude, if you had abandoned Tilt-A-World ride, we'd be doing that shit this weekend.
We'd be making a mech cockpit out of it. But yeah, I do dig it. I dig The Explorers. I really enjoy it. It's a movie I still enjoy. But it's a movie that, you know, the difference between Explorers and Gremlins for me is, you know, Gremlins is something, it's on, I can watch it. Explorers is something I watch, I go like, oh yeah, Explorers, and then that final act hits, and I'm like, anyway, moving on. Anyway, Explorers,
it's great. It's great that they named their spaceship after a Bruce Springsteen song.
Oh yeah.
Alright, with that said, we'll move on to our ugly, or least favorite movie by Joe Dante, and I'll give Mr. Grouchy Forbes the voice on this one first.
That's because you know what it is and you want to move on after it.
No, it's because you're typecast now, man. It's like the ugly is your topic. Yeah. I don't enjoy fun.
Human grumpy cat. Yeah.
You know, I'm going to say this first. There's not a movie that I haven't seen a Joe Dante movie that I hate. So my ugly in this is really more the far bad side of the bad section.
It's the one you like the least.
Yeah. And it's Gremlins 2, I think. To me, it's just a never-ending train of gags that Dante wanted to put in a movie, and it's not held together by anything. I think maybe you could make that work, but it just doesn't for me.
It's a John Landis movie.
But see, you know,
it kind of is.
Blues Brothers was amazing. That's a John Landis movie. It's a whole bunch of gags, but it works. This, to me, I don't know. Maybe it's the fact that it's trying to do Looney Tunes, and it's a little like when Sam Raimi goes too crazy for the Three Stooges, and it's just kind of like, hey, cheesy comedy, and I just want to fill my movie with it, and I don't appreciate it the same way that he does. But there's definitely some great gags in it. There's great moments. Like I said, John Glover's amazing in it. The what is it, President's Day?
Yeah.
Speech or cutoff speech is amazing. And it's got a great cast, but it's just, I don't know. I mean, it's so self-aware, but not in a really clever way. I mean, it was kind of novel at the time for that, but I just found it exhausting. And, you know, there was a lot of imagination there, but it also just felt cheap. And I think maybe because he was overextending himself, you know, making as many creatures as he could, there's the horrible, horrible, is it Tony Randall who does the voice?
Yep.
For that?
Yes.
Awful, awful gremlin, and I do not want.
That's fair.
For me, it's just, yeah. It's basically,
that's fair.
For me, it's like somebody who thinks they're hysterical and no one's laughing, but they just keep going.
Oh, so like Stipe. Oh.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's what it is. You've nailed it. And actually, now I do really hate it.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And now, here's a thing
also,
for you.
Also, sorry, can I just say one more thing? Because I thought this. I have only ever liked Robert Prosky in Thief. He's amazing in Thief.
Mm-hmm.
And every other time I see him, I kind of want to punch him.
That's what I was about to ask you. Imagine if Robert Prosky had been playing the character, played Grandpa Fred, the same way he played the villain in Thief.
Making the same kind of threats.
Yeah. Telling the kid he's gonna sell his baby on the black market.
Yeah. Dumping people into acid baths. That would be great. Robert Picardo is terrific in it. I think, you know, his character is really good. Throughout the movie, I enjoyed that, but yeah, mostly it's just I find it tiring.
Too much marzipan.
Yeah,
I can accept that.
I didn't want to. I wanted to grind you down until you had no humanity left.
No.
Okay, here's the question. How the fuck is Mr. Futterman in this movie?
Yeah. That's another thing. Is it takes
something? Didn't he get run over by a tractor in the first?
That takes away a bit of the brutality from the first one.
I only noticed the last when I started watching Gremlins again a few months ago. There's actually a radio announcement where it says that the Futtermans were just injured in the first movie.
Yeah,
I never really noticed
they were like tragically injured.
Yeah,
there's a real sense of
for the TV broadcast.
Probably. And older couple doesn't survive getting run over by a tractor.
It was kind of crazy. It was kind of fun. No, it wasn't fun. It was horrifying.
Ducky Harvester.
But you know, like, I would totally agree with most of what you said. You know, as a narrative, it is a complete failure. There's nothing there but craziness, and that's why I love it. So, you know. Who wants to go next? Steve or John? Matt and I will go last.
I'll get mine out of the way first. So I'm going to get back on the topic of small soldiers. Keep it nice and short, though. Small Soldiers is a film out of time. It's a movie that should have been released in the late 80s, around the same time as, like, Batteries Not Included and Short Circuit and all the stuff that kind of came around in the wake of the Goonies.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I should really say in the wake of E.T., but, you know, the very concept of it just screams 1980s Amblin. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know, it feels really hollow.
Feels really New Line.
Yeah. It tries
to be Gremlins. There you go. There you go.
It tries to be Gremlins with toy soldiers versus toy monsters, but it's neither as dark nor as funny as Gremlins. Kirsten Dunst and I forget the main character's name. They're really, really bland. And to me, any point of the movie where the Commando Elite aren't unleashing mayhem, it's boring. It's, you know, it tries to be a ton of fun, but it ultimately plays it way too plain. And like I said about the Burbs, it lacks her.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's trying to be a throwback to the 1980s.
It feels really calculated, like, I want another Gremlins in my career.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, I mean, there's also the fact that part of what made Gremlins so great was the character of the creatures, and there's something very just designed by committee about the action figures.
The Gorgonites are boring, right?
Yeah.
Gremlins, what's the monster? The poster of the movie, it's Gizmo, you see, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Gremlins 2, which, like I said a few minutes ago, too much marzipan, is marketed completely around the monsters.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Marketed completely around the special effect, around the Gremlins themselves. Small Soldiers has that problem.
Mm-hmm.
The entirety of that movie is the Commando Elite.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just, you know, this big beefy parody of the G.I. Joe toys we all used to play with.
Mm-hmm.
But besides, that's really all they came up with.
It's like a slew of references to war movies and such.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love the part
that the target audience would
love what they do to the Gwendy dolls.
Yeah, right.
It's hollow.
Small Soldiers would be my ugly, because, as I said earlier, I hate those Gorgonites. Hate. And Tommy Lee Jones, fuck that guy.
What?
What?
The Auctioneer, forget him. And it's Tommy Lee Jones that is most annoying.
You know what? I don't care.
If Lee Marvin had still been alive, he could have done it.
Lee Marvin has done a fantastic job.
That's combat.
They got Charles Bronson, then they realized he never said anything.
We just got a bunch of blank audio tracks.
Most annoying.
No, man, he had one line. I'm beginning to enjoy killing generals. Chuck, you can't say that, man. This is a kid's movie.
I mean, one of the most annoying movie-watching experiences I've ever had in my life, this is Tommy Lee Jones aside, was Rules of Engagement. This Tommy Lee Jones and Samuel L. Jackson flick.
Oh,
oh my God, just screaming freaking The Auctioneer versus The Shouter for 2 hours. It was nasty.
Oh, it's a street preacher versus an auctioneer. Tommy Lee Jones sounds like the lead singer of Primus.
Never to come now. So yeah, anyway, Small Soldiers, fuck that movie.
But
Brad, was there a bud there, Steve? Or?
But it's not my ugly. It wants to be. It wants to be so badly, other than the absolute pile of phoned-in commercial bullshit money grab that was Looney Tunes Back in Action.
It's no Space Jam.
Oh, fuck Space Jam, too. Ugh. Good Lord.
Thank God it's not Space Jam.
Brendan Fraser? Okay. You know, let's just take the most recognizable A-list celebrity we can at this point in time and stick him in a stereotypical, you know, Hollywood 101 PG family script, and let's throw the Looney Tunes characters in there spouting all their most memorable catchphrases in the hopes that we can reignite a marketing bonanza. And
you guys remember? Fraser, you guys remember Cottage Cheese?
Small Soldiers look like Jackie Brown.
No, do you remember Cottage Cheese? Like how it, like moms were all into that in the '80s? Because that's Brendan Fraser.
You can't have good lasagna without cottage cheese, man.
But my thing with Looney Tunes is, I can see where you're coming from, but I still feel Dante's passion for that, you know, for those characters in the movie. It really feels like he's having a ton of fun.
See, to me, it feels like everything that came whenever anybody ever tried to bring back Looney Tunes. The only time for me Looney Tunes was ever done proper was when Zemeckis did it with Bugs Bunny and Daffy and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You know, like,
yes.
Every other time anybody has tried to make Looney Tunes front and center, it has felt like a phoned-in cash grab. You know, it has felt like those early 90s Muppet movies, which we will not utter of, you know?
Mm.
90s Muppet movies that were terrible. You know, it's... You had a bunch of people who really, like, I mean, yes, I know Spielberg and Dante knew these characters, but whoever wrote these movies, like, whoever wrote Looney Tunes Back in Action, and I'll say the same thing for Space Jam, they didn't get what made these characters appealing in the first place, and they didn't write them to a proper audience. You know, they wrote them to try to appeal to, you know, the kids who want to say, buy me that, buy me that, buy me that, buy me that, you know, like, and it just... The characters weren't there. The plot was hollow as shit. You know, you want to see how it was done right? Look at the Disney relaunch of The Muppets from a few years ago. You know, that was a fan-freaking-tastic movie. That was a love letter to those characters. You know? But Looney Tunes Back in Action was everything that the Muppet movie, the new Muppet movie, was not. You know, it was just a soulless commercial exercise. And, I mean, yeah, Dante, I'm sure he loved the character, and I'm sure he thought it was great to be, you know, sitting down, hey, I'm doing a Looney Tunes movie, great, awesome, fantastic. However, I think it should have been in the hands of, I even dare say I think Spielberg should have handled that one. And he should have, you know, went back and overdosed on some Tex Avery and all of the good old stuff before he went in to do it, you know, some Frizz Freeling, some Chuck Jones and stuff, you know, but... This movie did not feel like Looney Tunes. It felt like just a commercial shit kids movie, you know?
Hey guys, remember Jenna Elfman?
No.
Yes.
No, I don't. And it's a phrase I use a lot. I use it with a lot of kids movies. I use it with a lot of these family, like these PG family comedies and stuff. It's a movie that feels genetically engineered to sell Happy Meals.
generically engineered. I changed one letter.
Look at you.
Said it all.
Shut up.
God, guys, you've lacked... I actually have life experience with this. I watched Shrek 2 with Steve and his wife.
Oh, Jesus.
And it's terrifying.
I got violent, didn't I, when we were watching Shrek 2?
You did, yeah.
Didn't I get very loud watching, like, this movie's such fucking bullshit!
Sarah, if you don't turn this shit off and let me play Onimusha, I want a divorce. I want a goddamn divorce. Oh, look, now they're singing 80s show tunes.
I don't know. I see what you guys are saying about this movie. I mean, Looney Tunes, it's not really my thing. I saw this movie for the first time about a week ago. I heard, you know, Gabriel's always said a lot of good things about it, so I'm like, all right, I'll give it a shot.
Should have been your first warning.
And it was, you know.
It's, and now we're not friends anymore.
I'm watching it for about 20 minutes, and I'm like, eh, you know, not great. But it really, I totally agree with him on the energy. Like, this movie... I get what you're saying about the commercialism and such, and I really agree. But it is the energy he kept going. The last hour of this movie had this momentum of just nonstop, you know, punch, 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 punch. It kept going, and I think that's a big credit to Dante and what he can do with the subject.
Is
there a more punchable face than Steve Martin's on the poster for this movie?
He was pretty awful. Like, I enjoyed this movie, but Steve Martin in it, oh, God.
Yeah, fuck that guy, too.
Should have been Kevin McCarthy again.
Also, you know? the tagline, you've got a Looney Tunes movie, and the most imaginative tagline they can come up with is, how do they solve a mystery when they don't have a clue?
Sad humble.
Hey, listen. Shut up.
I mean... For me, what I enjoy about it is having, you know, Daffy having the starring role, and some of the imaginative stuff they come up with, like, for example, the chase throughout all the paintings, which, you know, I don't think you'd really see in a completely soulless movie. And there's even, you know, they even make fun of the advertisement, and I still feel that, despite, you know, the commerciality of it, I still feel Dante's, like, sardonic look behind it, you know? But if it's not of your cup of tea, what can I do?
Move to America?
Said.
Ugly. Matt will agree. We have chosen what is probably the only really, really bad movie that Joe Dante has directed. His only true dud, and that is The Hole.
Do our opinions just not matter all of a sudden?
Outside of Looney Tunes,
you know what, guys? I think we should strike. Fuck
them. I agree with you, Gabriel.
We're not.
I got your back.
John, we're police officers.
Without cops, this podcast would tear itself apart.
Well, if you had, like, as much as you hate Looney Tunes, and I'll grant you that, it's still not as bad as The Hole. That's all I'm saying, because this movie is a hole. It is terrible.
So it's not the name, then.
Yes. This is a boring, boring, boring movie. It's terrible. It is drab. It has no imagination. It is a core to sit through, and it goes to the lowest common denominator for fear. Basically, it's about these teenage kids who move from Brooklyn into the suburbs, and they find a hole in the bottom of their new place, and the hole is like, grabs on to their worst fear and make them come alive.
I was gonna say gateway to the world.
Yeah, but like one of the brothers, his worst fear is like a creepy clown doll ripped up from Poltergeist. Their girlfriend is like a girl that she let die, and the other boy is his abusive father. that they come alive and they bring them in. Yeah.
It'd be cool if they'd use the movie as like a, I mean, I haven't seen it, but if they sort of tried to combine the sort of sense of wonder of some of the movies that Joe Dante did in the 80s with like this Lovecraftian gateway to another dimension.
It's more like
that's not what it is. I'm saying they did that.
I mean, the movie. I mean, I picked this as my ugly. Also, this movie feels like it's really trying to be one of his 80s movies. Yeah, it's got that, you know, the normal suburbs. They find something supernatural. It's about these teenagers, but it just he's stuck there, and it just completely lifeless. Like Gabriel said, the clown doll. It is creepy, and it's kind of what people will talk about. It's what you'll remember about this movie. But it's just so obvious.
You know, so kind of like the anti-Super 8, is it?
Basically, yeah. They call that.
Yeah, and basically the third act turns into a kind of PSA about how to overcome your abusive father, you know?
We'll see.
Even
Bruce
the acting
Dern is
powerhouse known as Terry Polo cannot say that.
It's like in Labyrinth where she says, like, you have no power over me at the end. That's basically the third act of the whole.
I like Bruce Dern in it, though. Bruce Dern is good in all of Dante's movies he's in. It's about the only redeeming quality I can think of for this movie.
The funny thing is, I remember when it... I mean, it took a while to be released.
Mm-hmm.
Correctly. And it seems to be that it sort of got a couple of showings... And the early things I read about it were like, oh, Joe Dante's back. He's actually made a creepy movie. And apparently those people were insane.
I think a lot of it had to do with the 3D, because I'm guessing Dante, you know, he's savvy enough and he has a good enough eye to know how to work with the 3D. But
I think I also read that they sort of had to compromise and use like one that was a bit darker and dimmer and didn't have as nice. But anyway.
Because apparently, by doing pre-research on Wikipedia, it won a prize at the Venice Film Festival for like most creative 3D film, and I'm like, yeah, that's damning with faint praise.
Venice, the city on the water.
What do they know about 3D?
Their pigeons do double takes.
But yeah, I mean. Once that's taken out, you get a really, really shitty movie.
And I guess, you know, like all of these sites that were talking about Joe Dante being back and stuff, Andrew, I guess the lesson learned here is you got to stop reading, like, Bloody Disgusting and Arrow to the Head. And
I wasn't reading those. I think it was the horrible guy who, like, edited Roger Ebert's blog and then prided himself on being contrarian.
Oh, Jim Emerson? I hate that guy.
And I want to set up
a fire. Fuck that guy.
We should strike. Fuck.
In that order.
I think we just created something new. I think we just created the fuck that guy list.
Alright, yeah, the whole stay away, far away as it, from it as you can.
I would never watch a movie named after a part of my own ass.
It's a movie and a review all in one.
Sticking with the solo crackola. All
right, let's wrap it up and go with your thoughts on Joe Dante. John, you go first.
Before we started recording, I said quite maliciously, Dante to me is the lesser of the Amblin boys. You know, it's he's got some good stuff. There's not enough words for how awesome Gremlins is. You know, I love The Howling, but I'm a werewolf nut. To me, it's just he doesn't have the his love of schlock and of 1950s late night cinema, you know, or like X, the man with the X-ray eyes and all that garbage. His love of that ultimately betrays him. He doesn't have the skill of a Zemeckis or even a Joe Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's better than a Columbus, though.
Hey.
He's on the list.
He's on the list.
Hey, nice.
Joe Dante could never have made Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
Wow. Oh, man, that would have been awesome.
Those first two Harry Potter movies are awesome.
I would have loved to have seen Joe Dante take on Home Alone, though.
That would have been.
I don't think Daniel Stern would have been getting up at the end of that movie.
You know, something tells me Daniel Stern's going to get out of this one. Okay, wait. Oh, he did.
directed by Joe the Mangler Dante.
And then there's a video report saying he was injured.
Yeah, that's right. When he showed up in the sequel.
I don't get it. Macaulay Culkin ran him over with a Kentucky Harvester. and Dick Miller would have been the South Bend Shovel Slayer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Every day he's shoveling.
Oh.
Parting thoughts on Joe Dante. Textbook. Very textbook. Which doesn't really lend him much of a signature style, and of course, film being a visual medium, you know, that's usually the first thing you latch onto when you pick a favorite, is like a style that you can relate to. For me, Dante doesn't have that. For me, Dante worked his best stuff when he was aping Spielberg.
Yeah, that's probably why he didn't really make it out of the 80s boom years.
Yeah.
Can't really, you know, not the 80s boom years, as if films went down the shitter after the 80s, but, you know, that whole era of family entertainment, and, I mean, there's a reason, you know, these movies we rented hundreds of times as kids, there's a reason we rented them so many times.
Exactly.
Right?
And I can only think of one that's come out in the last, what, maybe 7 or 10 years that lives up to those old movies. And, you know, Dante is not the one who was responsible for it, you know? It was J.J. Abrams, so...
The 80s are kind of Dante's strength and weakness at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, in the 80s, or in his prime. I like Small Soldiers, but it is firmly stuck in the 80s, and the whole... It wants to be the 80s so bad.
I mean, he thrives in a time when you can have a silly premise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, yep.
You can have extreme premises now, but the sort of silliness, there is just something kind of, you were allowed to be a bit goofy.
Why does that ninja have a laser sword? Duh, because it's fucking red.
Another big thing, like another observation, I guess, you know, we talk about movies like The Goonies, which of course is not Dante, but, you know, Goonies, Gremlins, Explorers, even to an extent stuff like Inner Space, like it all comes from the same DNA, it's all this same kind of blueprint. And even in the 90s, like even when you get into the early to mid 90s, kids were different too. You couldn't portray kids the same way, you know. The 80s kids, you know, they had that kind of wistful innocence about them, you know, like they were all like into the adventure.
But they could also swear.
Yeah, they could swear, you know, their mischievousness was smoking cigarettes behind the school or cursing at each other, you know. Whereas when you get into the 90s, it almost became a smarm thing, you know. It became like, oh, all the kids are smarter than the adults now, and, you know, they're all wisecracky, and...
And then they go mope.
And, yeah. Emo. They go emo.
But, I can't tell you guys, man, when I watched Super 8, a tear rolled down my cheek. Like, I started to openly weep in the theater when the fat kid looked at his best friend and said, God, you're such a dick.
Jesus Christ, you're such a dickhead.
My thing was done with Dante, although he doesn't have a recognizable style, he does have a recognizable energy, I find, in a lot of his movies, and a very peculiar sense of humor, you know, that I find that, for me, that's his signature, you know, although you can't recognize him by his style, you can recognize his movie by the energy and the humor he lends to them, and of course by his cast of actors. And I mean, this is a, you know, there aren't that many directors that, like, you know, like Matt said, he watched what, 5 movies in the same day. Yeah. There aren't that many directors that you can do that and not get burned down, you know.
Just kept going.
Because, yeah. because it just, you know, they're fun to watch. And I mean, there's something to say for that. I mean, of course, he's never going to be, you know, fucking Stanley Kubrick or, you know, Coppola or like early Coppola.
When he's making a movie, you can tell that he's having fun making the movie. You can tell that he's really putting a passion into it.
And,
you know, maybe he's not the most talented, but you can tell that putting everything he's got into it.
I should say, I do want to add that he actually, you know, he's not a hack like Wes Craven.
No, God.
Technically, like he knows how to set up a shot and film a sequence and cut it. And, I mean, like Gabe was saying, you know, he has the passion. But I would say, yeah, his sensibilities betray him. He doesn't have a lot of range, I think. He's sort of stuck in that macabre plus goofy, sort of split. And, the thing I like most about Joe Dante is listening to him talk about movies, because that's when you get a real sense of how much fun he thinks they are and how much he loves it.
Yeah, that's definitely true. That is definitely
go to Trailer. If you know, people listening haven't encountered Trailers from Hell, go to Trailers from Hell and listen to some of Joe Dante's,
It's funny because that's kind of true of like we kept pairing up with Landis to this episode, and Landis too is great fun to listen to. But like when you compare them both, I find that Dante has been on the whole more consistent than Landis and hasn't done as much. You know, he doesn't have a Beverly Hills Cup 3 or Blues Brothers.
Well, I don't know, but you know, I would say Landis, it was sort of a burnout phase, and then he didn't do anything worth seeing, and Dante kind of reached that too.
I think they're both the same person. I think the only difference, between Landis and Dante is Landis has kind of a more of a distinct visual style than Dante does.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of their styles, like their little fetishes and their little quirks, I think they're both the same person. I think they're like Siamese twins or something.
Landis had his little comeback, though, man. Burke and Hare was a lot of fun.
Burke and Hare was a lot of fun.
It was all right, but it didn't feel like a Landis movie to me. It felt like
definitely did to me.
And as much as I love Gremlins, it's still not the Blues Brothers.
No, it's better.
Whoa, no.
No. Don't go there, Steve.
I already went there. I went there on the Landis podcast. I'm not a big Blues Brothers fan.
Ruben Fuhrer? Get that car's license plate.
You're broken inside, Steve.
Yeah, go and talk to Brian Pope.
We had that conversation, what, a year ago?
You and Gibron can both go hate on the new RoboCop.
Hey.
I'm going to see it.
Hey. Don't lump me in that pile.
I might try to see that this weekend.
I've been hearing fantastic things.
I have not.
I have actually been hearing fantastic things from a few locals who've seen it. So.
You want a good thing? Check out, because I was, you know, I got a little bit, I think, Steve, you sent me the IGN review. And it's kind of, you know, the whole, the guys can't put away their nerd boner for the original. Which, you know, RoboCop is a fantastically stupid movie.
I know Matt's going to kill me, but you know what? RoboCop, the original, is not very good.
No, it's not. No. It's gore porn is all it is, man.
You're killing me. Stop it.
Yeah. No, it's immensely quotable gore porn.
Oh, it's a fun movie. It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's loud, it's stupid, and it's completely
better than it should be.
Completely 1980s.
I prefer a lot of vagina sunblock ad from the sequel.
So if you want to, hear our thoughts on
the fake warrior review.
Yeah, if you want to hear our thoughts on RoboCop and Paul Verhoeven, go back through the archives, look for the Verhoeven episode. It was a good one.
Yeah. you're gonna find out what hypocrites we are, because I'm pretty sure we all went fucking super gaga over RoboCop.
missed that one.
Yeah. Speaking of which, what are we doing next time, whenever that is, Mr. Forbes?
We are going to be looking into the good, the bad, and the ugly of John Borman. Nice. The kind of it's fairly visually amazing British director who unfortunately likes to film his daughter in sex scenes. It's kind of creepy.
And it's somewhat batshit.
So he's like the British Dario Argento, is that what you're
saying?
Yeah,
he is. He is the British Dario Argento.
Yeah,
Dario Argento never made anything as good as Point Blank.
Or Deliverance. I just realized Excalibur would totally be like if Dario Argento made an Arthurian movie.
Stop it, you're killing me!
Except, you know, if he had a stronger
voice. I never hit you! You're tearing me apart, Lisa!
I'm Steve Borman. You know, I defended Argento's visual style, but Borman is much better behind the camera.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's just a daughter thing.
The Exorcist 2 is much better than Dario Argento's Phantom of the Opera, that's for sure.
Better than very many.
We already did Argento, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
that was one for the books.
So, until then, there's only one thing left to say.
See you on a Wednesday that is at some point in the future.
And also, that's all, folks.
Okay, I hit stop.